Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's coronavirus and vaccine development update. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question anytime by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please note today's call is being recorded, and it's now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Rachel Newsom. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us today for our briefing, Coronavirus Science, Technology, and Policy for Vaccine Development. I'm Rachel Newsom, Vice President for Federal and State Health Policy at the Commonwealth Fund. For those of you who don't know, the Commonwealth Fund is a nonpartisan health policy research foundation aimed at creating a high-performing health system. Today's call is part of a Commonwealth Fund Alliance for Health Policy series on the COVID-19 pandemic. Today, we'll focus specifically on the progression of a COVID-19 vaccine and the related scientific and policy considerations. Panelists will address the science behind the vaccine and testing, the development and testing of a vaccine, where we are today in regards to having access to a widely available and accessible vaccine ready for the American public, and the research and regulatory roles of the Center for Biologics and Evaluation Research at the FDA. The pandemic will touch every corner of our health system, but we only have 45 minutes today, and we're going to be very focused specifically on the COVID-19 vaccine issue. All resources from our discussion today and from earlier teleconferences can be found at the Fund's COVID-19 resource page on our website. I'm joined today by experts LJ Tan, Chief Strategy Officer for the Immunization Action Coalition, Esther Krofa, Executive Director of Faster Cures, and Dr. Peter Marks, the Director of the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research at the FDA. We are thrilled that the three of you are able to join us today, and thank you for all you're doing to keep our family safe and protected during this unprecedented time. We'll start with LJ Tan on the science of vaccine development and what makes the search for a COVID-19 vaccine unique. LJ, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Rachel, and thank you for this opportunity to talk about a very important issue. I'm not going to belabor the point, but I want to say that I'm going to talk very quickly for 5 minutes about the high levels of traditional vaccine development and some of the things that we have to change and will have to change in order to accelerate a pandemic vaccine. And then obviously Esther and Dr. Marks will continue the conversation along those lines. Just to remind everybody that vaccine development is not simple. And traditional vaccine development through all its phases can take 10, 15, sometimes 20 years and can cost at least $800 million, even more. And when you build in all the costs to build a manufacturing facility, maintaining the equipment, the quality control that goes into that, the figure can go way over $1 billion to bring a vaccine from development all the way through to market. And it's important to keep in mind that, clinical development, especially that final phase three, generally involves a large number of subjects, and the reason for that is because vaccines are held to a very high level of safety and efficacy, and rightfully so. And so a lot of vaccines end up failing going into phase three clinical development simply because of the fact that the cost is prohibitive. And I remind everybody that the manufacturing processes that vaccine manufacturers undergo are incredibly stringent, very, very well audited, very well monitored. So safety and efficacy remains a big deal. And then, the final filing for approval to the FDA, obviously or globally, requires in-depth evaluation by the governmental regulatory authorities such as the FDA. So again, it's not a simple process. And if you think about the pathway of vaccine development, I'm going to walk us through that and talk quickly about some of the partners that have some responsibility in this. You start at the initial concept of the vaccine, right? This is where you make a decision as you identify what could be the vaccine product, the antigen is what we would call it. You would develop a manufacturing process. You think about the studies you need to conduct in animals, for example, to make sure that you have a viable candidate that you can take on. And this is what we call the pre-IND phase or the pre-investigational new drug phase. And generally the partners involved in that are people who are doing the basic science, like NIH, academics, from the defense does some of this. Industry also obviously does some of this. And during this process, they're in consultation with the FDA for their advice and review as well. Once you've got that candidate, you move on to what we call the investigational new drug phase, and that's when you think about that application for IND, you think about the clinical studies that you have to do, and at this time and point, especially with how expensive and how complicated the development of new vaccines are, there tends to be a lot of good public-private partnerships that have to happen to bring that vaccine forward. And Esther is going to talk a bit about this as well. And so partners involved here include Aspirin, BARDA. BARDA has done a lot of the public-private work, industry, and obviously FDA continues to be involved in this. And as you come out of this phase 1, 2, 3, these clinical trials, you then take the vaccine into licensing. And this is where you have to do a lot of the supplements for the biological licensing approval. You've got to do a pre-approval lot release. All this tends to then involve scaling up of the production. And in this case, a lot of times industry takes over because they have the wherewithal to actually scale up the production of that vaccine after licensing. And of course, FDA is still involved in consultation and review as well. And then finally, with the licensing approval, the vaccine goes out, and there's actually post-approval, post-marketing surveillance that's done by both the FDA and the industry. Facilities need to be inspected, lots need to be released, to be tested and then released. So a very complicated, significant process that results in the development of a safe and effective vaccine. So that's the traditional process. So if we're going to accelerate this, you know, what do we have to do? What are we looking at, right? So one of the things people are talking about are, for example, you know, with COVID-19 vaccines, we're probably going to have simultaneous rather than sequential clinical trials. So in other words, instead of doing them one at a time following each other, we're probably going to try to accelerate and compress them and do them simultaneously or in parallel, right? And these trials will probably be optimized for multiple target populations at the same time, and they will probably be occurring in multiple countries with different socioeconomic standings as well. This is to kind of accelerate that clinical trial process. And these clinical trials are likely going to use something which we call adaptive trial designs. And Esther may talk a little bit about this as well. And essentially, adaptive trial designs means that results are gathered during the trial, and they're actually used to modify the clinical trial's course according to pre-specified rules that you have arranged with the regulatory agency, of course. And this allows, obviously, then the clinical trial to shift quickly and be more flexible to accommodate data as it comes up. And obviously, in order to accelerate speed, you're going to run these clinical trials where your results are most likely. So in areas where there is disease, where there's high likelihood of disease, and that's going to be regardless of location across the globe. You're going to just go where the disease is. You're going to require continuous and especially early collaboration with regulatory agencies to make sure that they're engaged in this whole flexibility process, so to get rapid, appropriate approval processes going as well. Then finally, you're going to have early discussions on how we're going to incentivize a scaling up of the production of vaccines that have made it through the licensing process, right, and are approved, you know, either for emergency use or better. And that's something that those discussions for policy will have to happen fairly early. And obviously also to look for distribution of the vaccine fairly and equitably across the globe, since this is a pandemic. And all these discussions have to happen early. And as you can imagine, this requires strong global coordination, strong global collaboration. And that's something I think we're all going to be looking forward to in this COVID-19 era. So I'm just going to pause there. Thank you. And pass the baton on to Esther, I believe.
Great. Thanks so much, LJ. Esther?
Thank you so much. I was asked to talk about how we see the vaccine pipeline and some policy considerations for COVID-19 vaccine development. At Faster Cures, we've been tracking the development of treatments and vaccines on a daily basis and have put together a tracker that is on our milkeninstitute.org website, which has been very well received. That allows us to see what's happening with these collaborations and partnerships along different vaccine candidates over the last several weeks and months, and efforts that even began early on after the pandemic started to really arise out of China. We're tracking 86 different active vaccine projects underway. And again, as this is updated daily, there are always more that are being added to that list. Currently, we have 6 of them in clinical trials in different stages, some coming out of China with the Shenzhen Institute. There are 2 trials underway for vaccine candidates there. Inovio is in phase 1. We have a study out of UK, University of Oxford, also in phase 1. As many of you know, Moderna is in phase 1 based out of Cambridge. CanSino Biologics is in phase 2, and they're in partnership with the Beijing Institute of Biotechnology. And then we expect about 24 more to enter clinical trials by this summer and early fall. I mean, that is quite a huge number, as we heard LJ talk about what, you know, is needed in order for us to go through successful clinical trials. So that's what we see in terms of the pipeline. There's a lot of activity underway in partnerships between big pharmaceutical companies and smaller biotech, as well as university-led initiatives and or partnerships. Many of these collaborations are being pulled together to leverage the different expertise that these companies have, whether their manufacturing capability, whether their mRNA technology. The earliest partnerships were really accelerated based on prior agreements or relationships that these companies had with each other, and we're seeing that continued. Really encouraged to see the work of NIH helping to sponsor some of these clinical trials, for example, with Moderna. We also see CEPI, which is a coalition that was established to develop vaccines for emerging infectious diseases, and it's funded by many different countries, and they are funding and standing up a lot of clinical trials as well. So it's definitely a multi-sector, sets of collaborations with different kinds of organizations and entities that are involved. From a policy perspective, a few things that I wanted to highlight. I think it's going to be important for the FDA to have surge capacity, as we call it, which is having enough arms and legs and staff to be able to actively provide input into the clinical design and protocol of these studies, as well as the review of data as they come in quickly. We think in order to accelerate efforts, reviewing data in real time as these studies are happening will be important to learn quickly what's coming forward and pivot as needed. We also think it's important for FDA and CMS to collaborate closely as we see more of these studies go into phase three and potentially get approved, that CMS is prepared and ready from a coding and reimbursement perspective to ensure that the appropriate billing codes are available, that there are no significant delays that we see in access because we have not adequately provided clarity around billing and payment. So having that established agreement up front already, whether it's establishing parallel review processes if that's needed and or if there's work that's needed initially through the Department of Defense or others to negotiate advanced purchase agreements, something that may have been done in other instances with the stockpile, but not necessarily in this context. Maybe those kinds of creative solutions should be explored. But some initial ideas of how we can think about this from a policy perspective.
Thanks so much, Esther. And now we'll turn to Dr. Peter Marks.
So thanks very much. So you heard about the development and potential reimbursement. I would say that from the FDA perspective, and this may be a little unusual hearing this from the FDA, the agency clearly recognizes that the development of a vaccine for this particular virus is possibly one of the most important things that we're going to have to do in the next years because it is unfortunately not unlikely that we may see a second wave or even third wave if we don't get it right and get it right quickly. Unfortunately, we are dealing with a particular pathogen here for which we did not have candidates already in the pipeline. Now, although they're coronavirus vaccines, they're for other coronaviruses. It's also a pathogen for which we know that there might be some complexities in development, this issue of immune enhancement. So we're going to do whatever we can to help move things forward as best as we can. And what that will really mean from the FDA perspective is working with the various sponsors of vaccines to most effectively look at their preclinical data, understand as much as we can about the characteristics of these vaccines, help people develop development plans that are most efficient at understanding whether their candidates will get to levels of protection that would really warrant taking them forward. Because, frankly, vaccine candidates that have very low efficacy or not tremendous efficacy in this particular case could just distract from capacity for more robust candidates to come forward. So there really is a bit it has to be a very thoughtful program moving forward. Not to say that we'd say no to someone, but just to say that we'd like to encourage people to have the absolute best possible vaccines move forward here. Ultimately, what we will anticipate is that we will be working in a somewhat different way than we generally do, with sponsors looking in real time to look at data as it comes in, looking to decrease the holes between different stages of development, potentially making use of, as you've already heard, things like adaptive design trials. So we hope to be able to facilitate the rapid development of these. And what we're also doing is working with our federal partners because it's not just a matter of getting a vaccine through to approval. It's also a matter of delivering it. So I think we have to work together, kind of a whole of government approach, to think about everything from making sure the best possible vaccines make it into the population, as well as then that the population be very efficiently vaccinated, because there is this uncertainty. We could be in a period where we still have fairly active COVID-19 transmission if we get a second wave of this coming through. I shudder to think about that, but I think we have to be realistic that until there is an effective vaccine, although there are treatments being developed, those treatments or even prophylactics besides a vaccine will be very cumbersome to use on very large populations. And even though a vaccine will be very challenging to deliver to very large populations, it is certainly the most efficient way of effectively protecting people. So we'll look forward to working with sponsors and look forward to questions. Thanks.
Great. Thank you so much. And I know we have a few questions in the queue, so I'll turn it over to our operator to get the first one started.
Okay. And if you'd like to ask a question at this time, press star and one on your touchtone phone. Star and one on your touchtone phone. Go first to Sanjia Rahman with CQ Roll Call. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for doing this call. So I was kind of curious about the efficacy of a possible vaccine, given, the urgency to do this in a short period of time. And I was just kind of thinking about, the flu vaccine and how that's only effective against some strains. And I'm curious if this is kind of a concern that we get a vaccine down the road and it's not effective enough for everyone and for all kind of possibilities. Thanks.
LJ, do you want to start with that one? Efficacy balanced with rapid development?
Yeah, I think I will start with that one, and I think I will also punt this one to Dr. Marks, because I think he's probably got some good ideas on this one too. I do believe very strongly that that there is going to be very stringent and absolute outcome measurements on terms of safety and efficacy, even though this process is being accelerated, because it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever to put forward a product that's not efficacious and certainly not safe. So I think what we're going to be seeing is some compromise in terms of actually things like, for example, wanting some long-term data, for example, right? We may not have that available to us, although there might be some markers that we could look at. So for example, some of the traditional clinical trials go a little bit longer because we're looking for 2, 3, 4 years out to see what kind of effectiveness we have with the vaccine. Does it wane, for example? So those are some of the things that we're probably going to take a look at, and Dr. Marks can comment on that as well. But I think I want to keep reminding all of us that we have actually a very safe and effective vaccine approval system in the United States. It's remarkable the number of existing products that we have for vaccine-preventable disease that are safe and effective, and that's because we go through such a rigid clinical trial approval process. Dr. Marks, I want to punt this one to you, speaking from the FDA.
I think you've answered it very well. I think that there will be a balance here. I think we're very much hoping we can find vaccines that will have relatively high levels of efficacy here. We will have to be monitoring very closely. I mean, right now, there have not been mutations, to my knowledge, that have occurred that would fundamentally alter vaccine development programs in terms of the targets that they're going after. But we will have to be very vigilant for those, for any changes, and in which case the hope would be it would be much like, if that did occur, it would be much like an influenza strain change type supplement. But the real issue here is trying to get things moved too fast. You exactly as was said, we may not have the long-term data that we normally might like, and so we may be doing putting real-world evidence into practice in this case by vaccinating relatively larger populations of individuals. It could be individuals at higher risk or things like this, and then gathering data in the real world. And there actually are ways of doing randomized trials in the real world in situations that come up like this. So that's what I would probably envision here may happen.
Great, thank you.
We'll go next to Elizabeth Weiss with USA Today. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a question for Dr. Marks. Given the complex process of hiring at FDA, are you all able to begin hiring now for this anticipated surge, which could be a year, well, 6 months to a year out, or how will you deal with that? Because clearly it's going to take a lot more bodies.
Well, what we're doing right now is reassigning bodies to deal with this. And since some other work has quieted down a little bit, it is going to be a challenge, and it is a challenge already dealing with what's coming in. We have planned to staff up some. The hope is that over the coming months, as some of the social distancing and other issues start to cool off. I mean, we're still actually hiring through this, believe it or not. I've had video interviews with people, and others have done so at the center. But it should become easier, I hope, as things loosen a little. And you're right, we will need to staff up here to try to address what will be a large number of applications. Which will hopefully be a large number of biologics license applications.
Thank you. We'll move next to Caroline Johnson with The Washington Post. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. Maybe if Dr. Marks could talk a little bit about what can you describe, like sort of an example of what the structure of a trial that used real-world evidence could be? Like what could one of these more efficient later-stage clinical trials that also like maybe involved real-world deployment look like? And then also speak to what like surrogate marker you're going to use to determine that a vaccine is effective, and like also how durable that effect has to be for you to maybe think about approving it, since you're going to be working fast too?
So it's a great question, and a lot of that's going to depend on where the vaccine is when it gets towards that portion of its lifespan, the phase 2-3 trials, and what we encounter with whether they're circulating virus or not. If there's no circulating virus, my guess is we'll continue to work on whether antibody production is a correlate of protection. We'll be looking for the best immune correlates of protection is what we're working on right now. I think the various manufacturers are trying to understand that now. And then if there's no circulating virus, one would be looking for in the population for that, and that may mean that would potentially limit you to a more conventional, very large clinical trial. On the other hand, if you had a situation where you do still have virus circulating, one could imagine that as vaccine runs off of the fill and finish line, you might be able to set up a trial whereby essentially what you're doing is using real-world evidence by looking at cases in groups that have been vaccinated at different times and comparing them to one another, because by definition, we're probably not going to be able to vaccinate everyone simultaneously. So in different waves as people are vaccinated, you might see use those that are not vaccinated as the control during that same time versus the ones that are vaccinated in various areas. It's not perfect. I will be acknowledged right away that there are certain people at the NIH who I'm sure would like to tell me that that's a horrible design, but I think we're going to entertain and discuss in an open fashion all of the possible designs, because I just feel like in this particular situation, we can't dismiss out of hand any potentially useful design here, be it real-world evidence-based, traditional-based, or otherwise. Thanks.
Thank you. We'll go next to Jackie Lee with Bloomberg Law. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much. This question is for either Dr. Marks or I believe Esther had mentioned it earlier, the conversations that need to happen between various agencies, particularly with CMS and reimbursement and coding for potential vaccines. Are those conversations happening now? How long do you think that they would take? I'm just kind of curious if there's any sort of elaboration anyone can give on that.
I'm happy to start. This is Esther. As we've seen with CMS and their respective counterpart agencies across federal government, they've been quite rapid in providing guidance documents and making sure that any challenges around, you know, telehealth or telemedicine, those kinds of issues are being addressed. So I'm hopeful that they would very quickly be open to these kinds of conversations. As we know, the coverage and analysis group at CMS is quite small, under 10 career staff. So having the resources to be able to deal with what will be likely needed if we have multiple different vaccines that are FDA approved, I think could prove challenging. So that's why we're advocating for early and often conversations. I don't have a sense to what extent those conversations have started, but I do think that it's critical.
And I would jump in quickly on this one too. You know, I used to be at the American Medical Association, and I was actually there when we were working through some of the coding for reimbursement with the 2009 H1N1 vaccine. And I think that's the other side of the question that we're going to look at is when these vaccines get approved, we're going to have to deal with the fact that you know, are they going to be, who's going to be paying for them? Are they going to be relying entirely on the public sector, which is what we kind of did with H1N1? Or are we going to be more likely relying on both public and private sector partnerships, payments to happen? In which case, then, I think, you know, obviously, you know, there's a process for getting some of the coding that's required for private sector payments, such as CPT coding, that comes through the American Medical Association. And working on codes for those vaccines is something manufacturers, especially the big manufacturers that were mentioned, like GSK, Sanofi, Pfizer, they do know how to take care of some of those processes, and getting those codings in place so that when a physician or a provider puts in a payment request, they can be processed by obviously the private sector payers as well.
Gotcha. Thank you.
We'll go next to Sunny Young with S&P Global News. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. This question is for Dr. Marks. I wanted to know about whether the FDA would actually consider an emergency use authorization. Dr. Fauci had actually talked about that previously on the possibility of something like that. So would the FDA actually consider that for a vaccine? And then the other question I had was on the animal studies that are happening simultaneously with the vaccine candidates right now with the human testing in volunteers. Is this something that you could foresee happening in the future in other situations, or do you think you'll be under pressure in the future to then undertake this in other vaccine development in other situations where there's not a pandemic? Thank you.
So let me break that up into the EUA and then into what would happen with the animal, the animal studies that might be done and help support. So from the standpoint of EUA, we would issue an EUA, I think, whether we could or we couldn't would depend on the strength of the evidence that we saw. We would have to feel that the safety profile and the efficacy profile justified the issuance of an EUA in a setting. And it would probably also not just be the safety and efficacy profile, it would be what the situation was on the ground at the time. So obviously if there was widespread circulation and we had very good safety data and very promising efficacy data from a phase two study or a combination of information from phase one, two with very good animal data from animal models that we trust, could you imagine getting to an EUA in that setting? Possibly. On the other hand, if you didn't have circulating virus, but you're just trying to get people vaccinated, I don't think you'd see that. So that's the EUA portion. From the standpoint of the development piece, although I'm sure, like everything else, it won't be exactly the same after COVID-19 as it was before COVID-19. There are certain things about this pandemic that I think will be exceptional, and we would be able to call it exceptional if we do it. I mean, I can't think of anything that we've had in the past 100 years. Has anything taken our economy out? It's a combination of taking our economy out. We'll take out, by the time this wave passes, probably between 50,000-75,000 people easily. So I think there probably will be a situation here in the United States alone. That's what I'm talking about. And globally, it's even more, the enormity of this is even greater. So I think this is probably an exceptional circumstance in some way, although I acknowledge that like everything else, like telework will never be the same again, or working in the office will never be the same again. Vaccine development again, probably will be different, but I can't actually predict for sure how it will look differently, at this time. And some of that will be depend on how things go as this development of these vaccines go. But it's a great question. I wish I had a better answer for it. Thanks.
We'll go next to Tina Tsai with Science News. Please go ahead.
It's Tsai. I'm sorry. My question is about how much protection would you need to be seeing from a virus vaccine before you would go ahead with these compressed timelines and multiple stages of clinical trial going on at the same time? Do you need a certain level of protection demonstrated in a phase one trial before you would do that?
I let one of my colleagues comment on that first, and then I'll be happy to try to chime in. Not. Okay. So I'd say this. Obviously, there's going to be, there's no set number. But let's just remember what we know from previous vaccines, that the ideal vaccine here is one that when we vaccinate the population, when we get to a certain number of people vaccinated, that with a certain percent efficacy of the vaccine, we get herd immunity and we wipe things out. That's what happened with smallpox. It's what basically is happening with other things like measles if we wouldn't have it reintroduced, or polio. And so you'd like to have very high efficacy. If you don't get there, well, we would probably take the next best thing, because having some people protected is better than having no people protected. But it does mean that you mean if you have a vaccine that has relatively less efficacy, you end up with a situation like where we are with seasonal influenza, where you have only a portion of the population protected, and you have to deal with circulating virus. So obviously we'd like to try to do our best here, but we can't have perfection be the enemy of good. On the other hand, I think we shouldn't set that's the reason for trying our hardest right now, using preclinical models and using people, really using as smart a development approach right up front, so that we try to make the best choices right now. My motto here is a woodworking one, which is essentially measure twice, cut once. The only kind of change to that motto is measure quickly twice and cut quickly once.
Okay. I'll jump in quickly also on this idea of effectiveness, right? I mean, I think especially with adult vaccines, we as vaccine people are aware that in the adult population you're going to get effectiveness numbers that vary because of the diversity of the adult population, and I think that's obviously, as Dr. Marks has already mentioned, that's something that's obviously that's going to be a criteria. But I think the other thing that we want to keep in mind also is that that speed to a vaccine here is important, and I think we don't want to have perfection be the enemy of the good in this case. And I think we want to make sure that we have a safe and effective vaccine, and that effectiveness number, I think, is going to vary. I don't think there will be a threshold number that will not be considered. And Dr. Marks, I think you can correct me if I'm wrong.
I agree completely that right. No, that's right. I think the answer here, though, is that at the beginning, to the extent that we can aim high, is a really good thing, and to the extent that I think, at least the piece that my unique perspective on this is that it's time to really mobilize as best we can in our animal modeling to try to compare things to the extent that we can, and to try to sort things out before they get to humans to the extent we can, knowing that it's never perfect to make that transition, because the difference between whatever candidates go forward, right, there is an opportunity cost to taking any candidate forward. And so you want to take your best candidates forward, because by definition, they will occupy capacity over one another. And so to the extent that upfront you can make very informed choices between two vaccines or three vaccines or four vaccines about which one has the highest likelihood of having the highest correlate, leading to the highest amount of protection in the greatest number of people, you'd like to do that. Because remember, we're not talking about just vaccinating, a few hundred thousand individuals. We're talking about vaccinating a few hundred million people in this country alone and a few billion people globally. So one really would like to try to get it right to the extent they can, obviously working at a very rapid pace.
If I could just quickly jump in, I mentioned this earlier in my initial spiel, is this idea that also, looking at multiple target populations, right, and there might be a vaccine candidate that's going to be a little bit more effective in the elderly population versus the young healthy adult population. And I think that's where the idea of simultaneous trials happen, right, this, of multiple arms in a trial, so that we can kind of get a sense of that kind of effectiveness as well.
Thank you. We'll go next to Gail Dutton with Biospace. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I was wondering about, given the accelerated timelines for the trials, when you believe the first vaccine will become available?
I'm punting back to Dr. Marks.
Let me just say this. I would say this. I think that there's what is likely and what is desired. What is desired, obviously, if I had a magic wand right now, is that everything would go perfectly, and somehow, you know, 9 months to a year from now, we'd have some vaccine that might not be perfectly licensable, but would at least be able to be, if we had virus circulating, be able to be used, as Dr. Fauci has suggested, in an EUA. If we look at what is most likely timelines, we're probably looking at a vaccine. Again, this is total speculation, but would be speculating on, you know, if things were going, it could be 12 to 18 months. So I don't know what it will be at the end of the day. I do know the following, though, that from the United States government's perspective, everything should be brought to bear to bring down those timelines to absolutely the minimum amount necessary to get to the best possible vaccine that is safe and effective. And I'm pretty sure that that's the same objective globally of our partners, either in Europe or in WHO as well.
And I would just add that we're seeing the big companies place a big bet on that time frame as well. I mean, J&J has come forward to say they're adding capacity to make 1 billion doses available, hopefully by the end of 2021, as has GSK and Sanofi with their partnerships. So I would say there's alignment even from the company perspective of pushing as hard and as quickly toward that 12 to 18 month timeline.
And that's the timeline I was going to throw out there, was 15 to 18 months. And then I want to remind people that if you think about the 10 to 15 years, this is actually quite a remarkable accomplishment, requiring remarkable coordination and collaboration from both the public and the private sectors.
Thank you. We'll go next to Natasha Lindstrom with the Pittsburgh Tribune. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Just going off, you mentioned that, you know, vaccine candidates with low efficacy could distract from capacity and more robust candidates. You also say that, you know, you want to entertain all possible designs, and we know that this is a slow process. At what point should a group of vaccine researchers say, okay, this isn't working, we need to scrap this or pivot or work on something else? Should they know that on their own independently? Is that something the FDA will be kind of suggesting to them at some point? And then with these efforts being so expensive and taking up finite resources, as you said, how do you balance these dual needs of competition versus collaboration necessary in this race for the vaccine? Will there be a point where, you know, maybe a few top candidates will emerge and fewer people are working in silos and focusing on a few out there, because it seems to be there's competition, which can be a good thing, but it also is, as you said, taking away resources, costing money. How do you balance that competition versus collaboration going on here?
So, again, I'll just take this as somebody who's done drug development before. I think this is a great situation we're in right now, which is, I think it's great that we have, I think it's like ideation here. So what's going on right now is ideation. I think our job as the federal government, and it's not just with FDA, it's also with BARDA, National Institutes of Health, and that's what this active partnership that Dr. Collins announced is. The idea is to look over what's out there. Now, we're not going to tell someone, I don't think we're going to say stop developing something, but what will happen probably is by where the government puts its investment and others put their investments, the best candidates out of the 60 to 80 that are accessible in preclinical or further development, those will hopefully be identified and their development will be expedited, and things will hopefully essentially naturally take care of themselves in terms of what moves forward. I think it is the right thing to be ideating here, because I think you never know when there could be some diamond in the rough or some old technology for that matter that comes up and saves the day. So we need to be very open-minded, and I think ultimately the free market will take care of this, because those things that look that are evaluated and will look promising by these various efforts will come forward. Some will have to die a natural death if they don't show the kind of efficacy that they need to, or if they show safety concerns that are concerning. So that's what I would suspect would happen. But I actually am very encouraged by all of the different ideation going on, because the more ideas here against ASOL, like this particular pathogen, the better.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Dr. Mark, and I like the fact that, you know, you start with the competition. Having healthy competition during this ideation phase, as you call it, is awesome, because then you have basic science doing its best thinking, old and new technologies, and then, as you've said, the market will select. And again, funding sources will also select the best ideas. And then at that point, you move into less competition but more collaboration.
Thank you.
We'll go next to Caroline Johnson with a follow-up from the Washington Post. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Just one other question. On the regulatory side, when do you begin having these discussions about the structure and timing of the phase 2-3 trials? Like, for the ones that are already in clinical development, are you beginning those discussions now? Or when does that, like, the meetings between you and the sponsors start to occur? And when do you start hashing out, like, potential design?
So we start meeting, we've been meeting with people even before they submit their investigational new drug applications, and the conversations about what these development programs might look like, although I can't tell you any specifics because obviously those are confidential with the various manufacturers. I can tell you that across manufacturers, we're engaging as early as they would like in these conversations about what a phase 2-3 development program might be looking like. And I think, to be honest, all of them, And this is not speaking about any specific application. They're all ideating over the different things that the different ways that that might look like, depending on whether or not they're circulating virus or not. And that, I think, is also showing forethought in planning for various contingencies that might exist.
Okay. And then when you're maybe one of the others could speak to when a vaccine does begin to become available, whether it's in like a large phase 3 trial or otherwise, how do you start to think about who gets it first, and also having maybe like a registry or some kind of way to scale enrollment really fast or access?
So in traditional vaccine policy, what happens is after the vaccine gets obviously put out there and approved, there is a committee that takes a look at it and makes recommendations as to how the vaccine should be used. And I would be surprised if that committee, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, doesn't get involved again on a COVID-19 vaccine. And in fact, I am aware that they're actually starting up a working group on that. And I think that group will look at some of the policy decisions in terms of kind of like the same way they looked at it along with the National Vaccine Advisory Committee for the 2009 H1 vaccine, as well as for the influenza pandemic planning process, right? Who do you tier first and foremost to get the vaccine as they roll out? Because you're not going to get all the doses at one time. And I think and the good news is that there are these committees that will probably take a look at that and bring their expertise to bear in terms of identifying who gets the vaccine first. And I think there's also important roles to play in terms of messaging the vaccine as it rolls out, in terms of, you know, to the public, so that there's public awareness of the vaccine, its safety, its effectiveness, and obviously its use as well.
I mean, and then just on that last point, I think is going to be important from a messaging perspective for the public to be aware of that tiering scheme. So whether it's going out to first-line healthcare workers or emergency responders first, and being able to then define the timeline for where they'll be most accessible to patients or to the general public, that would be important, particularly as we saw early confusion around testing and where testing was made available and to whom testing was made available and whether you're symptomatic or not. So having clarity along all of those fronts will provide a lot of guidance to the general public, because when we see an FDA-approved vaccine, many people might think they can just call their doctor and have access to it, which is likely not going to be the case.
Great. Thank you so much again. This is Rachel Newsom from the Commonwealth Fund. I just wanted to once again thank our speakers for stepping away from their work, their really critical work, to share their insights with us. It's been really an incredible conversation. Thanks to all of our attendees for joining us today. This has been recorded and it'll be available on our website. I also want to apologize. I know we didn't get all of the questions. Please feel free to reach out to us by email. And as I mentioned, we're going to be holding additional teleconferences around our response to the COVID-19 pandemic, And we hope this one has been helpful to all of you. Stay safe, stay home, and thank you so much for joining us. Take care.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.